Welcome to Books Nerds Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart. Lovely to be with you this morning here on RN. On the show today, you'll meet Damien Bateson, an artist who is building a boat, but it will never put to sea. You'll find out why later on. And we visit the city of Geelong in Victoria, still reeling from the news that its giant Ford factory is closing. This weekend, they're hosting a 24-hour extreme arts event, a walk, starting at the Yuyang Mountains and winding up at the mouth of the Barwon River.
It's a connection to country. It's being able to be in a place and say, this is where I belong. It's then being able to care for the country and look after it so that we've got something to give.
But first, a very, very, very special novel, one you're going to love reading. Well, the Australian Vogel Prize is a hugely prestigious award. It's a prize for an unpublished manuscript by a writer under the age of 35, and it's launched the careers of some major writers, including Tim Winton, Kate Grenville, and Mandy Sayer. This year's winner is Christine Piper, and she has written a smart and melancholy historical novel. It's called After Darkness. Now, the story is narrated by a Japanese doctor, Tomokatsu Ibaraki, and when Japan enters the war, the Second World War, he's working in a tiny little Japanese hospital in Broome, the pearling town on the coast of tropical Western Australia. Like hundreds of other Japanese, Italian and German residents of Australia, he's interned in a remote prison camp. This one is in remote South Australia, and he's there for the duration of the war. The irony is that Dr. Ibaraki has fled to Australia to escape the horrors of Japan's research into germ warfare. Now, Christine Piper is very well informed about this germ warfare program. She's written a separate essay about it, which appears in this month's edition of Australian Book Review. And here's the kicker. The essay has won her the Calibre Prize for an outstanding essay. So she's won two prizes for the one piece of work. Christine, congratulations and welcome to the program.
Thanks, Michael.
This is just wonderful. So let's start with the historical work you've done, because it's very substantial. So the Tokyo Army Medical College, let's go there, just before the outbreak of the Second World War. There's a special department there called the Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory. Sounds like a good thing.
That's right. But it wasn't. They actually did some very bad things in there.
So it's a centre for germ warfare research.
That's right, yes.
So tell us what they were doing.
So in the Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory, they were first developing bacteria to use in biological weapons. And then there were later on when I guess the testing started happening in Manchuria in other parts of China, they started analysing the bodies of murdered test subjects who'd been experimented on using these biological weapons.
Yeah, so they'd given people, basically, these appalling diseases. Let's list some of the diseases.
So plague, anthrax, they did experiments on those, botulism, poison gas, all sorts of nasty things.
Let them die, pickled their bodies and sent them away for research.
That's right.
So this is the notorious Unit 731.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So that was the name of the unit, the largest unit in Manchuria. But there were quite a lot of other different units throughout China and also in Singapore as well.
They love these euphemistic names. Unit 731, which, as you say, was operating in China, was known as the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department.
That's right,
of the
yes.
Kwantung Army. I mean, this is just obscene, isn't it?
They did some horrific things. And the sad thing is that it's still not very much is known about it today. And the people who were spearheaded this development actually got away with it all, and they were never prosecuted.
And the people they experimented on were referred to as logs. Logs.
Yes, that's right.
And this was a joke.
Yeah, it started off as something lighthearted, they said, and then apparently the name stuck. So the Unit 731 was actually disguised as a lumber mill, and so they started calling the test subjects logs.
Very funny. So you've told this story in your essay, which is called Unearthing the Past, which, as I say, won the Calibre Prize for an outstanding essay, and it's the background for your novel.
That's right.
It's just a wonderful book you've written. I'm sorry to go on about it, but it is marvellous.
Thank you.
Central character is this chap, Dr. Ibaraki, who's a very ethical, very precise sort of man, but he's, I don't know, there's something wrong with him. He sort of can't express love, can he? He's almost grown accustomed to being lonely.
He's very emotionally stunted, and it the reason for that is only revealed sort of in the second half of the novel, and it is, of course, because he's been involved in these horrible experiments in Japan, and he feels a great deal of guilt about it, and so that affects all his relationships in later life.
Yeah, we don't learn about all this until the second half of the novel, and I suppose some listeners might feel like we've given the game away, but, gee, I don't know. It's not like it's a suspense novel, is it? It's not that this is the sort of mystery at the end of the story. And anyway, you've given the game away yourself by publishing in one of the most widely read critical journals in the country, Australian Book Review. So it's your fault if people are going to complain that we've given it away. So he is married. He's got, a very long-suffering, very patient wife.
Yes, that's right. So he is married, but then his work at the laboratory, because he has to keep it secret from everyone, it really starts to affect his relationship with his wife. And, I don't want to give it all away, but they eventually part ways for
yes,
a while.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we won't give it all away. Don't worry. It'll be fine. So he leaves his wife in Japan and he heads for Broome, where he runs the Japanese hospital. And you really evoke this fantastically. It's basically a room.
Oh, the Japanese hospital in Broome. Yes, it's basically, they call it a hospital, but it is sort of like just a room with one doctor. The thing is, Broome used to be quite a big, bustling, pearling town when there were 3,000 or so Asian divers, and that was sort of just before World War One was when it had its peak. But by the time my Japanese doctor arrives, it's sort of really at the end of its. The end of its time, and there aren't so many pearl divers in town anymore, and he was in a very small hospital. And I just wanted to point out that my doctor arrives in Broome in 1938 to work at the hospital, but actually, in reality, the last doctor to work at the Japanese hospital in Broome left around 1928. So that's one example of how I sort of twisted, I guess, the historical facts to suit my narrative.
How inconvenient.
That's right.
Yes, it isn't horrible when that sort of stuff happens. Oh, Nara, this is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking to Christine Piper, who's the winner of this year's Vogel Prize for an unpublished manuscript. It's now published, because that's what's happened when you win the Vogel Prize. They publish you. And it's called After Darkness, and it's just a wonderful book. So we end up in an internment camp in South Australia, and it's a real camp.
That's right. So the Japanese civilians were interned in three camps in Australia. One was in Hay, New South Wales, and the other one was in Tatura, Victoria, and that was for families. And the other one was in Loveday, South Australia, which is where I set most of my novel.
And they make interesting places to explore, fascinating places, because everyone's under such pressure. So the ideological and cultural differences between the inmates really become exaggerated.
That's right. And the irony was that even though they were all sort of interned under the banner of Japanese enemy alien, it was a very diverse camp population and they had very different backgrounds. In Australia, the internees, many of them had been arrested overseas. For example, the Japanese population, about three quarters of them have been arrested in countries such as Dutch East Indies and French New Caledonia, and where they were living and working, and then they were sent by those countries to Australia to be interned. So it created a lot of friction at camp and these really diverse camp populations, and that became one of the sources of conflict in my novel.
Well, you're particularly interested in Japanese prisoners who are either Australian citizens. I mean, there are a couple, you know, sort of good
yes,
A mate kind
right.
of Australians who can't believe this has happened to them, and of people who are of half Australian, half Japanese descent. And that group are really a shadow world in the camp, accepted by neither side, really.
That's right. And because of my background, my mother is Japanese, when I was researching and in the National Archives of Australia and I was reading all these thousands of military reports, I found that I really was drawn to the experience of these Australian-born or mixed-race Japanese because they were really caught between two cultures and welcomed by neither. You know, they, although they consider themselves very loyal Australians and some of them had even signed up to serve in the AIF, they were interned for the duration of the war. And then when they were at camp, they in turn clashed with the sort of more nationalist camp leaders. So their struggle with identity and loyalty became one of the focuses of my novel.
Mm. I've had a fascinating year around this topic, Christine, because I've read Richard Flanagan's book, The Narrow Road what's it called, the narrow road to the
deep north.
Yeah, I can't remember what the adjectives are. The narrow road to the deep north. Shame and the Captives by Tom Keneally, which is also set in a prison camp. And then earlier there was Mark Dappan's book, The Spirit House, which is a man reliving his ordeals on the Burma Railway. What do you make of this surge of books all about POWs and World War II?
Yeah, someone else pointed that out to me, and I suppose that enough time has passed for people to want to go back to it and to revisit these sites of trauma. I mean, a long time has passed now. It's been 70 years. And I suppose often when you lose people who have these direct connections to history, it makes the sort of the younger generation want to explore it more and write about it. Mm. So I think perhaps that's what has happened.
Well, it's fascinating to read all three of them. Not least because Richard Flanagan has a doctor at the centre of his story and you've got a doctor at the centre of yours. Lots of parallels. And you agree with Tom Keneally that the officers who ran the Australian internment camps were sort of well-meaning, kind of bumbling people, but you know, quite naive, really, in the face of war and conflict.
Yeah, that was one of the things that surprised me when I started out researching this topic. I guess my uninformed view was that the camps would be a little bit like Nazi concentration camps, and they really weren't that bad at all. The internees were fed quite well. They couldn't be forced to work. That's not to say it wasn't very stressful and a difficult situation, but also I thought that the conflict in my novel would arise from the clashes with some of the guards who may be mistreating the internees. But then when I was researching it, I really couldn't find any instances of overt, you know, mistreatment by the guards. So I had to find conflict in another way. And I think that's right, that, the guards did overall treat the internees fairly well. And they did have a degree of empathy for them.
Given the places you could spend the Second World War, an internment camp mightn't be such a bad option.
Well, I mean, it really depended on the people. Like, some of the internees found it very difficult to be separated from their loved ones.
Sure.
And there was a fairly high rate of attempted suicide among the Japanese. But they certainly weren't lacking in sort of the basic necessities, for the most part, food and shelter and that sort of thing. But it was a hard kind of life, and particularly hard for the people who didn't fit in. And that's why I really focused on the experience of the Australian-born Japanese and the half-Japanese.
On Books and Arts Daily, we're talking to Christine Piper, who's written a book called After Darkness, and it's just won the Vogel Prize, which is a good reason to talk to her. Some reviewers have commented that this is quite a simple novel, and it is a simple novel because it reads so beautifully. Emotionally, it's very rich. But actually, I reckon the people who've said that it's a simple novel are endorsing your skill, because the time structure of the book is actually quite complex. I think what you've done is that you've got one story that runs from beginning to end, but you've started it in three different places, like a fugue. So the first one starts in Japan before the war. That's Ibaraki and his wife and his research. And then you jump forward to his time in Broome, running the Japanese hospital, and then his present predicament in the camp. And we switch between those three times. Is that what you've done?
Yes, that's right. And plotting the novel was by far the hardest element for me to do.
A nightmare. Did you write it all in chronological order and then break it up into the three different strands?
No, I was writing bits and pieces as I went. And I think that's just how my brain works. I started off trying to write it in order, but then I got really stumped. And I said to someone, I know what's going to happen at the end, but I just don't know how to get there. And the person said, well, just write the end and you'll work it out. And so I was writing bits and pieces here and there. And it somehow came together.
It did somehow. Yeah, it really did. I mean, it's effortless. It's seamless the way you've done it. It works so well. Now,
Thank you.
Do you fit into this story? As you were saying, your mum's Japanese and your dad's Australian. Where do you fit into this? Or what have you discovered about yourself by telling this tale?
Well, I suppose it sort of confirmed things I had already discovered about myself more when I was a teenager in my early 20s. But, you know, it confirmed that there is a multiplicity of identities and what it means to be Australian can be so different. And, you know, I look on identity as more something that's affected by the people you surround yourself with and, you know, what's made up around you rather than being fixed or anything like that.
But is this because it was a struggle for you, Christine, having that mixed heritage and living in Australia?
I mean, to be honest, I have to say that growing up in this environment as half Asian in Australia has been much more of a boon than anything else. You know, I have experienced isolated incidents of racism, but overall it's been a good thing that I'm half Japanese in Australia. But I have always felt like a bit of an outsider, and I don't know whether that's because I'm half a Japanese or whether because I just have, you know, more of a writer's sensibility. But certainly a lot of the narratives I've written have been exploring themes of identity and belonging, and, you know, it's something I'm very interested in.
Do you know about the talk of Australia developing a germ warfare program after the Second World War? Have you looked at that at all?
No, that's very interesting.
Yeah, well, Sir Macfarlane Burnet in 1947, who of course is one of the heroes of medical research in Australia, secretly urged the government to develop biological weapons for use against Indonesia and other what he called overpopulated countries of Southeast Asia. This all came to light through the work of a historian called Philip Dawling back in 1998. And, of course, Macfarlane Burnet went on to win the Nobel Prize for Medicine. He moved on to other issues. But the fact that he was talking about such things in 1947, a man who we remember as a great humanitarian, is a sign of how very much on the agenda this kind of work was.
I had no idea. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah, I first heard of it some years ago, and I've never forgotten this extraordinary detail. Now, you wrote this book and the essay as part of a doctorate in creative art. So we're seeing more and more of this, people writing novels as part of a PhD. How did that work for you?
Well, it was difficult and a long process.
Would you recommend it, though, as a route to getting a novel out of you?
Yes, I would recommend it. It certainly worked for me, and you know, one of the reasons why I enrolled in the Doctorate of Creative Arts degree was because I wanted to write a novel, but I am very much a deadline-orientated person, and I need an external, you know, structure and an external set of deadlines to really force me to create. And so it did work for me, and also the essay that won the Caliber Prize. I'd always wanted to write a long creative nonfiction essay, and then doing the doctorate was my chance to do it.
So was the essay part of the doctorate? Was that the nonfiction part, was it?
Well, it was I did four chapters for my the nonfiction part of my doctorate, and that was one of the chapters.
So this really paid off. This is this is the doctorate that really delivered. It won you two prizes.
Yeah, it has really worked out well for me, I have to say.
Well, it's given Australia a wonderful novel. Congratulations, Christine. It's a fantastic work, and all power to you.
Thanks, Michael.
Christine Piper. Her novel is called After Darkness. It's published by Allen & Unwin, and it's the winner of this year's Australian Vogel Award. And you can read Christine's account of her research into the Japanese germ warfare program in her essay. It's called Unearthing the Past. It's published in the April edition of Australian Book Review, and you can read that online, actually. There's a link to that on our website across Australia. This is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily. Now, talking of prizes, the writer Erin Handley has written a very provocative op-ed piece in today's Melbourne Age. She questions the outcome of the Stella Prize. This is the Australian Prize for Women's Writing. And this year the prize went not to a novel but to a work of non-fiction, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka by the historian Claire Wright. So Handley argues that fiction and non-fiction books should not be competing in a single category. In fact, she says non-fiction has an unfair advantage in the Stellas because the judges seem to favour works which celebrate women. And that's a task more suited to non-fiction. The chair of the Stella judging panel is Karen Goldsworthy, and she thinks this is wrong. She's tweeted that comparing fiction and non-fiction is no harder than comparing books in general. So I wonder, what do you think? Should the Stellas be a prize for all classes of women's writing? Maybe they should have separate categories within the Stella Prize. But then, given the fact that the prize money is just $50,000, maybe it should just be a fiction prize. So what do you think? All in or just some? It'd be good to hear what you think. You can talk to us on Twitter or go along to our website. This is RN, Books and Arts Daily.
Hello, Vanilla Kernerbone here. Now, if you're interested in design and architecture, then you might have heard me on By Design on RN. But I also host another show on Triple J that's dedicated to electronic and experimental music. And I must say, it's wonderful to be playing you music right now on The Inside Sleeve each weekday from 3 here on RN. So whether it's folk, alt rock or beats, it's great to have your company. That's The Inside Sleeve with me, Fenella, weekdays from 3 on RN.
Good on you, Fenella. Well, one of the best ways to get to know a city or a place is to walk around it. And this week, if you're in Geelong, which is in Victoria, you can take part in an extreme Arts Walk. It's called M2M 2014, or Mountain to Mouth. It's a 24-hour walk. It covers 80 kilometres, and you start at the Yuyang Mountains and then wind down through the countryside over a day to the mouth of the Barwon River. They're calling it a pilgrimage, and there'll be spontaneous performances and music and extreme art installations along the way, and some participants will carry water and fire on their journey. There's even a phone app which will contribute stories in various locations. This is a biennial event, and it sounds like a good example of how a former industrial city is recreating itself through cultural participation. You'll be hearing some music and a bit of poetry from the project first up, but now, time to hand you over to Joel Carnegie for a preview of what's in store.
Nyura, Wadarong Akinal. This is Wadarong land.
There's a turning in the tide, they say, sending shivers far and wide. And there's no sand that doesn't shift with each new wave.
You call this place home? It's your country now. And it doesn't matter where you go in the world. You can always say, that's my place. That's where I belong.
With that welcome from Wadarong Community Elder Brian Powell, today I join you from the clifftops of Geelong's Corio Bay. In the distance we have the spiritually significant Yuyang's mountain range and a dynamic yet somewhat fading industrial landscape scattered before me. To my left, sounds wafting across from the carousel are intertwined with bird calls. So why are we here? Well, we're here to discover M2M, a walk, a songline, and a pilgrimage from mountain to mouth.
Well, M2M is a walk, essentially, but it's an extreme arts event.
Mimi McDonald is the artistic director of Mountain to Mouth 2014.
And by that we mean that it's art in extreme situations like the outdoors. So M2M carries a canoe that's been crafted by a wonderful sculptor called Benjamin Gilbert. And it'll be carried across this land for 80 k's, carrying water from the ancient waterhole at Big Rock at the Yuyangs through 12 walking circles where the canoe rests for a short time. And then it'll arrive down at Barwon Heads to the mouth of the river. And that water that is carried in canoe from the waterhole at Big Rock will be returned to the river at the mouth of the river at Barwon Heads. Also carried in that canoe is the fire. So it's fire and water, and with many different people from very different backgrounds coming together on this one 24-hour journey.
We find ourselves right now on part of the walk. Can you describe for us the vision that you see in front of you and describe exactly where people will be walking to? We see far off into the distance the Yuyangs looming with this fairly unfortunate weather today. It's very hard to actually see them, but we can point out they're there. So describe that journey from the Yuyangs, and where do we go from there?
Well, from the Yuyangs, we'll be starting off in the afternoon at 3:30. And as you can see, between us and the Yuyangs is an industrial heartland of Geelong with this kind of billowing smoke and chimney stacks. And we'll be passing through the heartland of that industrial zone in the evening. So it'll be like walking through industrial fairyland, if that's a possibility, to have those two things together. But a unique opportunity where you just wouldn't, I think, go for a walk by yourself through that zone. So we're going to be walking, following canoe, with the 12 flags of the 12 wards of the council of the city of Greater Geelong. And we're going to be walking through that zone at night with lanterns. And as we come through and around this bay where we are here, we'll come into the centre of Geelong at Steam Packet Gardens by about 10 o'clock at night.
We head now from the waterfront of Geelong up to the historical National Wool Museum to meet an elder of the Wadarong community.
Hello, my name is Brian Powell, and I'm an elder of Wadarong people. every time I travel off country, as I come back, as I cross over the borders onto Wadawurrung country and coming down here to Geelong, I feel like I've come home. Now, that's the spirit that people that live here should have. It's a connection to country. It's being able to be in a place and say, this is where I belong. It's then being able to care for the country and look after it so that we've got something to give to our children and our grandchildren, because we don't own it. So the spirituality is about connecting and to be able to feel like, well, this is home. The place that we're in now, this Woolstore Museum, was right in the centre of a bowl. And there's a creek that flows just behind us, off the hills, down underneath where we are and out into the bay. And that was a freshwater supply. The wetland, which is in front of the town hall, only about 100 metres away, was our resources. That was our supermarket. That was our food. That was where we gathered eggs, birds, plants, reeds. It's where we got our water from. We lived around that water hole. And from here, you could see the Yu Yangs, and they are a significant place in our mythology. So when the boys were ready to transition into men, the elders would come and get the boys and take them away from this campsite and take them up to the Yu Yangs to start their journey. And they would teach them the law at each point along the journey. And the journey could take 3 to 6 months to travel and come back. But when they came back, those boys were men who were able to stand with the rest of the warriors to protect the women, to provide for the women, and to live as men amongst the tribe.
Back down to the waterfront now to visit an active partner in the M2M project, with an ambitious plan to revolutionise creative industries and knowledge economies in the city, Deakin University.
If you think about Geelong, one of the old regional cities of Australia.
Professor Jane Den Hollander is the Vice-Chancellor of the University.
If you look out of my window here across Corio Bay, you have the whole history of Australia before you. The history of Australia, of course, from settlement. You have wool just off the Cunningham Pier, one of the richest cities in the world at one point when we were exporting wool around the world. If you go across, you can see Ford, you can see Shell, you can see Alcoa. Great icons who've had their time as part of the manufacturing era, and now you're sitting in one of the ninth largest university in Australia. The digital economy, the knowledge era is upon us. Geelong Grammar to the one side, Geelong College to the other.
Like many post-industrial cities of the world, Geelong is having to reinvent itself. As old industry moves out, creative people and industries are moving in.
But the one connection that we must always have is with our First Nations people. And so the symbolic journey from the top of the mountain down to the bay, from where our First Nations, Indigenous people, their sacred sites, from one sacred site on the mountain down to this wonderful part of the bay here, Corio Bay, is a very symbolic connection from our great history, our originating history of the First Nations people through settlement and all the things that have happened, the agrarian economy, the manufacturing economy, to the knowledge economy. Art, culture, history is our future.
Mimi McDonald, Artistic Director of M2M, is still with me. We're going to continue on walking in just a moment, but that very much that sense of closure when you walk past, as people will be on Friday and Saturday, walking past the Ford factory and even Avalon not too far away, there is a sense of, well, you know, this is closing up, what's next? What role do you see the creative arts in its broader sense playing in the redevelopment of a city that's in a post-industrial age, as you say?
The creative arts engages with identity by bringing people out to do something together over a period of time, in this case 24 hours, and to see each other in their different landscapes and communities, to see each other for what they are, in a sense. So these 12 landmark walking circles will reveal something of the communities that have built them and the artists from those communities. Many of the 70 artists involved are professional artists, that's how they earn their living. Others are venturing into the arts for the first time, or otherwise they're amateur artists. We're breaking through barriers with the project, both in the arts arena but also crossing into other arenas like environment, like local government, like industry, like future planning, like academic research. You know, it's the arts can bring us together onto the one platform.
Well, why don't we continue our walk through part of this contemporary song line?
Why don't we?
On RN, Joel Carnegie with that story for Books and Arts Daily. And the Mountain to Mouth walk will take place from 3:30 p.m. this coming Friday. That's the 8th of May. It'll take 24 hours, with the walkers taking the trek from the Yuyang mountain range down to the mouth of the Barwon River. All of that in the country of the Wathaurong people. And the walk coincides with the Geelong After Dark Festival, a free pop-up arts festival happening across central Geelong on Friday night. And you'll find details on the Books and Arts Daily website. Well, boats are in the news at the moment. Boats of asylum seekers turned back to Indonesia by the Australian Navy. Noah, played by Russell Crowe in the new movie, building his massive ark to survive the deluge unleashed by a furious god. Boats and ships searching for that missing Malaysian plane. But the news has overlooked Damien Bateson. He's a Melbourne artist who's building a boat with a difference. Let's pay him a visit. G'day, Damien.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm terribly well. So we've come to see this boat of yours, which I've just told the listeners is a boat with a difference. It's made of stone.
It is made of stone. It's an idea that's been floating around, shall we say, for a little while in my head, and I've been granted the opportunity to make it happen.
So let's explain where we are. We're in the Yarra Sculpture Gallery, which is in a sort of industrial part of Melbourne in Collingwood. I'm guessing that you know a bit about landscape gardening, because that looks to me like a dry stone wall building technique you're using there.
I do know a bit about landscape gardening. I actually come from that background, and I have over the years migrated into working with stone. It's a very rewarding material to work with.
So we've got a little boat here that's it's about 2 metres long, about a metre wide, and it's got sand in the middle of it. Is that just there to sort of hold it together, or is that because you're going to plant something in the middle of it?
It's really a shell of dry stone, and the sand is being packed in to support the layers, because it's a boat upturned, so it's upside down. So as you can imagine, the sides are receding towards, or they're moving towards the centre.
Oh, I see. We're going to look at the bottom of the boat. I thought it was a funny shaped boat. I thought it gets wider towards the bottom, but the boat's okay. I've got it. The boat's going to be upside down. We're going to be looking at the keel when you're finished.
You are. Yeah, that's right. And whether we put a rudder on or not, I don't know. That might be going a bit too far.
So, as you run your stonemason's eye over this structure, what are some of the features that a novice like myself wouldn't catch?
So, all of the chisel marks, the folds perhaps, or the natural patterns that you might see in the natural face of the stone on the hull, that can kind of, you know, it can represent you know, some bumps and scratches that you might undergo on a journey somewhere.
And there's a bit of a sense of movement, actually, because all the lines from the way you've laid the stone are horizontal, and even the sort of veins that run through the stone are horizontal, so they capture the sense of the forward movement of what otherwise is a very static stone boat.
Yeah, and I that's true. And I'm trying to, you know, shape the hull so you get that at the front of the boat where it cuts through the water, you get that nice curve where the hull sort of opens out and then wraps around to the back. So it you're right, it does have movement, and although I've taken photographs of it, it never does it justice. Your eye needs to, you know, run along the outside of the boat and just appreciate that curve.
All right, so what are you going to do along the bottom? You've got a big pile of slate here, actually, a huge pile of slate. I didn't see that when I first came in. What are you going to do with that?
Okay, this is roofing slate, Michael, and it has a lot of lichen on it. So if you look around on old Victorian buildings, you see that sort of greenish tinge, and that's going to be used for the hull, I hope, if I have enough of it. It sort of represents barnacles. Perhaps it looks a little bit like a barnacle that you might see on the bottom of an old boat.
So it's going to have, when you say the hull, you mean the bottom of the boat. So the sides will remain this stone wall effect. And then as it curves up underneath to create the bottom of the boat, the keel of the boat, you're going to do that in blue slate.
That's right. So you'll get a bit of a change in colour. So there'll be a layer where it will change colour.
It makes a lovely sound, doesn't it? Just yeah, it's so resonant.
Some of the slate is repurposed, so it's been salvaged from... While I was walking to my daughter to school one morning, some fellows were pulling some roofing slate off a roof, and I asked what they were doing. They said it was going to the bin, and I said, no, it's not. So they then threw it into the back of my ute. I believe it comes from either Cornwall or Wales originally, so it would have come across to Australia as ballast in shipping. And believe it or not, we used to export our bluestone, which was quarried out of Footscray, where I now reside, and that was used as ballast and sent back to the UK and used for building back in the UK.
Isn't that extraordinary? So we're in Melbourne today, and one of the distinctive stones of Melbourne, you see it all over Melbourne, especially 19th century buildings, is this very distinctive bluestone, which is the stone of this particular region. Pretty hard to work, I imagine, that bluestone.
Bluestone's actually very nice to work with, providing it doesn't have any invisible faults in it, which you can find. But providing a block doesn't have faults in it, you can actually carve it quite nicely. You can shape it, and it's a very forgiving material, as long as you hit it in the right places and hit it in the right way.
You've just got to know your stone. You've got to have a thing. There has to be a bond between the blood system of the man and the structure of the stone. So this stone that you're building here, which is not bluestone, this is a lighter sort of stone. What are you working with here on the boat?
Okay, this is Castlemaine slate. So it's fairly famous in Melbourne. It's been used a lot in residential, even commercial, and whether it be in paving or structural work. It's a proven material. It's locally sourced. The quarry is still in operation, and it is a beautiful material. It has a great array of colours, or a great palette of colours, you know, oranges, purples, you get your creams and greys, and you even get a little black water crystal which grows in between the layers. People mistake it for a fossil. It's actually a water crystal.
Your eyes are lighting up when you say this stuff.
There are none visible on here, but they tend to happen on the horizontal layers, so you get it more in paving than you get in walling.
Now, let's talk a bit about how you come to be doing this, because sculpture isn't your full-time gig. What do you actually do to make a crust?
I work with stone. I also work in the landscape construction industry still.
So you're a stonemason, are you?
Yes. There are several different types of stonemason, obviously. There are your monumental masons. There are your masons that work purely on benchtops and vanities and things like that. There are your masons which work on, say, old institutional buildings in the city. So you might call them a banker's mason. Sometimes a banker's mason might call me a bush mason or something along those lines, but predominantly my work is with the raw material, so something that's been quarried and it's in a random fashion. It's either been blasted out of the ground, out of a quarry, or split out of a quarry, and my job is to shape it and put it into a structure, be it a wall, paving, or in this case a sculpture.
All right, and how did this opportunity to turn your skills to sculpture come about?
Well, I have to say that occasionally in my work I'm allowed creative license, which is great, but this opportunity presented itself through, talking to friends and one who happens to be a practicing artist, and he referred me to a couple of galleries, and so I wrote my proposals and I was accepted into Yarra Sculpture Gallery.
Now here's the thing, we're in a workshop, you've built a stone boat on a concrete floor. How are you going to get it out of here?
The same way it came in, piece by piece.
So you mean every time you you show this, you're going to have to rebuild it.
That's right. It's going to have to be rebuilt every time. But that's part of the experience, I guess. If it's going to go into another gallery space, or if it were wherever it's to be installed, it's going to be rebuilt. So whoever happens to witness it at the time gets to see a little bit of how things are put back together.
So what's your message to the cosmos?
Okay, I think I'd like to see. I guess I'd like to see more of the use of stone in contemporary building, especially since we're chasing after a more sustainable way to build. Stone is actually a very sustainable product. It can be reused. It takes minimal energy, especially in this case. The energy used to shape each piece here is human energy. So I just need to eat my breakfast at lunch and dinner, and I can. And get my sleep, and I can do what needs to be done to make this work.
So as long as you're eating ethical grains for your brekkie...
True, that's true.
The thing is all completely sustainable.
That's right.
All right, well, congratulations. It's coming out well. It'll look nice when it's got a bottom on it. It'll need a bottom, otherwise it'll sink. It's been good to meet you. I'll let you get back to work.
Thank you very much, Michael.
On our end... Damien Batson there tapping away. He's a stonemason, and you can see his boat as part of a show at the Yarra Sculpture Gallery if you're in Melbourne. It's on this Friday, the 9th of May through to Sunday, and also next week, Wednesday, the 14th of May through to Sunday. There are details of that on our website. This is Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart, where we turn now to fantasy, and an epic fantasy by the American writer Brandon Sanderson. It's called The Stormlight Archive, and it promises to be a 10-part series. So the first book is called The Way of the Kings. That established the world in which the series is built, a world of shard blades, high princes and assassins. The second book is just out. It's called Words of Radiance. Constitutional lawyer George Williams has been exploring the Stormlight Archive. George, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So tell us about the writer, Brandon Sanderson.
Well, he really is the big new thing in the field of epic fantasy. He's someone who first came to notice through a series of books called the Mistborn books, and then he was actually approached to complete what was then the biggest epic fantasy going, and that was the Wheel of Time series that Robert Jordan was writing. Robert Jordan died, only having completed 11 of the books in that series, and Brandon Sanderson came along and finished the last three, and that really cemented him in the mind of many people as not only a great writer, but with an incredible ability to pick up the threads in what was an epic story and to craft something new. And he is quite prolific, you have to say, not only in the volume of books he's writing, but in his capacity to develop entirely new worlds, new conceptions of fantasy in a way that is becoming immensely appealing across that genre.
So let's talk about the Stormlight Archive. So you've read both books.
I've got to say, you've got to be a glutton for punishment for this particular genre. And look, I love this stuff, but we're talking here about 10 books, as you've said. Each book is over 1,000 pages. And in fact, the second book, the one we're reviewing, The Words of Radiance, is at the absolute maximum length that the publisher can bind. So it's the longest possible book that can be written. It's 1,088 pages. And not only is that text, but it includes short stories as part of it. It's also a lot of artwork. In fact, it's a remarkable work. As Brandon Sanderson says, it's his love letter to the genre of epic fantasy because it includes so many different forms, the epic story, the short stories and the artworks that really create something quite new in this field that is really pushing the boundaries and giving people a sense that you can combine things in quite a different way, including a bit of poetry, to produce a new form of fantasy fiction.
Now, George, where do you find time to read a 1,000-page book? You're a constitutional lawyer. You're surrounded by enormous books by definition at work.
Well, look, and I write enormous books myself, I'd have to say. I've got a 1,500-page constitutional law book I write, and I'd have to say that the last thing I want to touch at the end of a long day is anything to do with the law or politics. I like to be transported somewhere entirely new. So I've got a soft spot for those world builders like Brandon Sanderson, who do create something absolutely fresh, really vivid, with strong characters. And that's what you get with these type of books, and that's why they have such a legion of fans, because they create worlds unlike anything else. And if you can think of this particular endeavour, it's something that will span not just years but decades to finish. And the canvas that he has of 10 books, each of around 1,000 words, in a sense every book is a trilogy of its own, is quite unlike anything else in terms of its ability to sustain that world building and that characterisation. And if you're prepared to go along the journey, and you've got to hope you live long enough, frankly, to see the end of it, given how long it takes, it's quite an extraordinary opportunity.
Don't switch me off yet. I haven't read volume 10.
Well, and this is an issue with some of the others. And we've got, of course, George R. R. Martin, who people know now through the Game of Thrones on HBO and in Australia. And his books have been the source of great contention. That's one of the most popular epic fantasy series of recent years. But that's a series which he started in 1996. He's up to book five. Here we are in 2014. He's got a couple to go. And his fans are very concerned. They write a bit about his health problems and are worried he might die before he finishes the series. And that's a real issue here. Robert Jordan did die before he finished his series, and we've just got to hope that Brandon Sanderson, at the current writing pace, he's about 38, he's got to live to about 70 if he writes as slowly as he currently is, because if he gives us a book every 4 years or so, it's going to literally take another 32 years to finish.
I never realised there was so much at stake. This is a real life and death issue.
Oh, look, it is. It is. And the fans, these are real communities that grow up about these things, because not only is it intricate, but what you see is extraordinary websites and online communities growing up between books about the story, about where it might head, people writing their own fiction. Brandon Sanderson is someone who contributes to that. He puts deleted scenes up on the web from the books and annotations and all sorts of things that really hook people and get people involved. So when the next book takes a while to appear, people get more than just a bit antsy. This really matters to them. And as George R. R. Martin has shown, it can actually lead to a bit of nastiness online where people start abusing the writer and asking whether he's really giving the attention that the book needs to finish the series.
Oh, you'll just have to work harder, they're saying. Stop tweeting and get back to your desk.
Well, they do. And with Martin, they've said, why are you doing this or that? Get off the TV series and finish the books. And is this or that taking too much of your time? And it's led to some pushback from him, saying his life is his own. And he gets to make these sort of choices. But when you embark on a quest of this kind, where you invent a world and draw people in, people want to know the ending. And if it's going to be a 10-book series, as this one is going to be, well, it does give a sense of responsibility in the minds of the fans to get it done in a timely manner.
So we're talking about the Stormlight Archive, George. Book two is Words of Radiance. We better just cover book one quickly so we can set this up. What happens in book one?
Well, a lot, you'd have to say, at 1,000 pages. But it's a different pace to a lot of fantasy books just because of the size of the canvas, given that as such a successful author, he can say it's going to be 10 books and it will be published. But book one is setting up the main characters. You've got characters in a familiar setting in that there's a brooding evil, a world under threat, but we're not quite sure in book one what it is. New characters coming into new powers, and as with Sanderson's other books, very highly developed magic systems which have a real logic to them. In book two, you start to get a sense of exactly what that evil is. The Voidbringers, as they're called, start to emerge and they take on some shape. And you actually see the main characters really coming into their powers in a very significant way. And what that's setting up in the future books is what will undoubtedly be some giant battles, some giant conflicts, and the rise of an extraordinary range of new users of this magic system who will need to deploy all of their talents and overcome their weaknesses in order to battle this rising evil.
So, George, in book one, we're introduced to something called the Knights Radiant. What's that?
Well, it's an order that goes back thousands of years, and like many of these books, there's a very elaborate backstory that comes through in the story through fragments of text and fragments of ideas. And it was a group of knights wielding these powers, which included powers of illusion through to extraordinary physical powers of flying and the like, and they disappeared a long, long time ago. And this story is about the re-emergence of those people through particular individuals who have to come to terms with society's dread of this particular group, and also the fact that there's no particular education for them anymore as to what they can do. So it's the reforming of this group that book two is really about. But it's really just at the beginning stages, and you get a sense that there's a lot more that's got to be told.
And a new element in the second book are the Pashendi. Who are they?
Well, they are the group in Book One who are essentially the menial servants throughout this society, and the economy depends upon these people. And what you learn very early is that there's much more to this group, that in fact it may be this group that becomes the void bringers, the group that ultimately is going to pose the greatest threat to this society. So Book Two is about understanding their role, getting to look through some short stories into their own minds, their own customs and the like. And they really start to come into their own towards the end of the book, where you can start to understand exactly what sort of threat that they're going to pose. But what you find here is you do find there's a lot of familiarity, but it's not like some of the other recent fantasy books where these characters are arising in a setting where it's very dark. It's not George R. R. Martin. It's not the grim, dark fantasy books of people like Mark Lawrence and Joe Abercrombie. This is old school in many ways, in that you won't find a sex scene in the book. You won't find a lot of graphic violence. So you're telling these sort of settings in a way that Sanderson himself is much happier with. He's got a strong religious background, and one that I think will have quite a broad appeal as a result.
It's more wholesome than Game of Thrones.
Look, it is. It's very much so. And there's a deliberate avoidance of the Game of Thrones with its incest, graphic violence, torture scenes. You won't find your favourite characters dying off quite so quickly. You will find a great imagination and a great story, but it is a real turn away from what has been a modern trend of these books, the leading ones, towards real darkness, grim dark as it's called, into something that isn't the elves, dwarves and orcs of old, which is where the genre really started with Tolkien, but something that is wholesome, that, you know, Sanderson himself with, you know, he's got very strong religious beliefs, is someone who takes quite a different tack on these things and doesn't want to communicate that sort of dark vision that others are currently doing.
George, could you be persuaded to write a book about fantasy?
Look, absolutely not. I'd have to say that being a constitutional lawyer in Australia certainly does involve a bit of fantasy sometimes, in right. that you've got to have a bit of a vivid imagination to fill in the gaps. But no, for me, this is I wouldn't call it a guilty pleasure, but it's a real pleasure to inhabit other people's worlds that they've invented. And I'm only too happy to read them and experience them, and I enjoy doing so, but I'm not someone who is a closet fantasy writer. I don't have any hidden desires in this area. I'm more than happy to read and enjoy.
Do you read other forms of fiction?
I do, yes. And look, my mother over a very long period of time has sought to tempt me away from the fantasy genre into all sorts of areas, but with only limited success, I'd have to say. I mean, I enjoy science writing and other forms of writing, but science fiction and fantasy are what I like. And in my work, I read enough of other things to think that I need a bit of time for the stuff I really enjoy.
Good on you, George. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
George Williams, he's a constitutional lawyer and fantasy fiction buff. And Words of Radiance by Brandon Sanderson is published by Tor Books. Now, we should remind ourselves that we're reading All Quiet on the Western Front. That's our book for this month, our European classic by Eric Maria Remarque. It's the story of a young man who enthusiastically, or a group of young men actually, who enthusiastically sign up for the war in 1918. And it's a very bleak, very striking evocation of the trenches of the Western Front. I wonder whether you've read it. Do you see it as a novel about war or against war? If you head to the specially dedicated page on Books and Arts website, you can leave your comment there and we can include it in the program, which will be on the last Friday of this month. So we're all reading All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque, and we'll convene the book club on the final Friday of this month. Tomorrow on the show, the third of our future forums, we look at the future of funding for contemporary art galleries and ask how they can survive if government funding is indeed drying up, as so many people fear it may be. But now it's time to talk about Bush Telly. Hi, Cam.
Michael, how are you going?
I'm good.
We'll talk unemployment today. One of the recommendations that was in the Commission of Audit report released last week was a suggestion that young single people who are unemployed, if they can't get a job, they should be forced to move if they're going to, rather than keep getting unemployment benefits. Now, that's got people in regional areas particularly interested because there's plenty of nice coastal spots, if you like, where young people are not finding it terribly easy to come across work. So we'll discuss that today. We've also got another study to look at around the organic sector, organic food, and what it means for your health. So those stories are more coming up very soon.
That's Cameron Wilson coming up with Bush Telly straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Let's talk again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
He is one of the most hated trolls on the internet. So why have respected technology, commentators, lawyers and experts been defending him? This week on Download This Show, Weave, and what he means for computer security everywhere. Plus, quantified sex. Yes, is there really value in tracking your love life? We're going to tweak the nipple of gamified intercourse because, well, it's the internet. That's Download This Show with me, Mark Fennell. Go ahead and do it right now on the RN website.